You're listening to the Oz Media Report. My name is Dan Barrett. On the podcast this week, I've got an extended conversation with Tim Burrows. If you're the sort of person who's pressed play on a podcast called the Oz Media Report, I don't really need to explain who Tim Burrows is to you. But just in case, he was the founder of Mumbrella, which is Australia's leading news website regarding the advertising marketing industry. And recently he left Mumbrella. On the way out, he said that he's off to write a book. Now, usually when a person ends up leaving a role and says that they're off to write a book, that's just the polite way of saying that they've got an uncertain future and they don't really quite know exactly what they're doing next. But what's unique here is Tim actually went off and wrote a book. So he's got this new book out, it's called Media Unmade, Australian Media's Most Disruptive Decade, and he explores what happened over the past 10 years in Australian media. Obviously there's been a great deal of digital disruption during this time, so he dives deep into that. This is exactly the sort of book where if you're the kind of person listening to a podcast called The Oz Media Report, you're the ideal audience. This book is exactly for you. It comes in just under 400 pages with a fairly lengthy index section as well. You're the ideal reader. Check it out. I've gone through this. It's not exactly a breezy weekend read, but like it's not onerous either. Really fun read. Give it a gander. But I have a chat with Tim on the podcast this week about the book, about the future of media, just a very general chat about all things Australian media. Anyway, enjoy. We're going to take a listen to my chat with Tim Burrows. I've been doing a Sopranos rewatch lately. The very first episode has Tony Soprano on the couch saying, "It's good to be in something from the ground floor. I came in too late for that and I know, but lately I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end. The best is over." Now, I know a lot of us feel that way about the world at times, but in terms of having a career in Australian media, that absolutely felt true to me. Back in 2016, I started working for the media trade magazine Media Week. I was only there for about a year, but during that time, I could see visibly that the parties were getting less good, the launches less audacious, and the stories I'd hear about freebies from launches, well, it was better than anything I was seeing. Actually, HeyU did give me an iPad mini, which my mum's still using. That was pretty cool. But Tim Burrows, have the best times of the local industry passed us by?
Oh man, look, there's so much to unwrap from what you've just said. Like, firstly, that little piece of audio from Tony Soprano, it just sent chills down my spine when I heard the music in the trailer for The Many Saints of Newark, which is going to be amazing, but that's kind of off the topic.
I know, that's why I'm doing my Sopranos rewatch. I'm getting right into it.
Yeah, no, I cannot wait. And as a fan of all things Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, just, you know, the involvement of Miami Steve Van Zandt as one of the characters as well makes it even better. Are the best days behind us? So I've been a journo for about 30 years, and I reckon for the entire time, people have been moaning about how the glory days were about 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
And that's always been the case. Yes, the freebies maybe aren't quite as ridiculous. You know, at the height of the madness when I was writing about media and marketing in Dubai, I went to the launch of a television channel in which they drove us out to a helipad, where they then helicopters us onto the Burj Al Arab to land there for the press conference to announce the launch of a pretty average television channel.
Yeah.
So we don't quite, you know, these days, I'm not going to be at all ungrateful for what we do receive, but yeah, they're probably not helicopter based anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably telling that I got an iPad mini and not an iPad. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But also, shout out to the good people at HeyU.
And the thing is, I used to tell off Mumbrella's reporters so often about, don't sound entitled. And here we are, we're being the very worst of it. Two journalists moaning about how the freebies aren't any good anymore. And by the way, we used to have a policy that if somebody sent out a freebie worth more than $100, it would have had to go back. So we would have had to send the iPad back.
Look, I receive so few things that I don't mind sort of talking up the handful of things I got over the sort of year or so that I was doing that. Also, as far as I'm aware, Media Week didn't have that policy. So as I said, my mum's been the very happy recipient of the iPad mini since then. But thinking
well, how about, that, w- yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry, talking over you, and I am on a slight delay as well, which is one of the downsides of being in fairly remote Tasmania.
Look, I was thinking, obviously the question is about like whether the best times have passed us by, but what are the knock-on effects of the less garish level of events taking place? So you mentioned in your book pretty early in that the media industry, well, think about like the media buying industry. It's fueled by a lot of cheap junior staff who are paid terribly, but they kept passionate about their jobs through the parties, through the free dinners. And as a former junior buyer myself, that rang really true to me. But if the parties are getting to be less good and less glamorous, will buying agencies suddenly have to start paying their staff better?
Oh, yeah, there's a couple of things to unpick there. I think, firstly, if we are going to sort of look back on, what we're really missing from times when things were, better resourced, which I guess was when, media was incredibly profitable, which it isn't always now, is when it comes to journalism, it was just the layers of quality control. As a journalist or a writer, you'd probably get a very strong, challenging brief from a chief reporter or something before you set out on a job. So you'd really have to think about what you were going to get. You'd then be challenged about the question you'd asked and the facts you got. And then in the writing, it would go through a number of levels of editing, which by people who are more experienced than you, who would probably find errors that you didn't even know that you'd made. And each time your copy was polished that little bit more. So I think if there is, sort of joking aside, I think if there is an issue around the sort of loss of something in the media, it's those tiny hidden pieces of quality control. But I think, to your question on the media buying side of things, the people who buy the advertising. I think the challenge anyway for so many media agencies is that model has just changed. On the one hand, a lot of things that had to be done manually can now be done automatically. So, that sort of manual, what they used to call the spots and dots of media buying, a lot of that can be taken out. But at the same time, one of the great contradictions of media agencies is the thing they should be really adding value for the client, the advertiser, is the quality of the thinking, that insight that says, if we think about our audience in this way and target them in that way, then we can just achieve something a little bit better. We can buy their advertising more efficiently for them and get a better result. And yet that's the bit they're not really paid for. The model of how agencies are paid doesn't usually really pay for the strategy. So you end up with these more junior people who aren't paid very well. So I do think that the media agency model generally is broken. It's broken from the client side. It's broken probably from the career side, because as you say, it's not paid terribly well. And in these ages where no one can actually get to go out and actually attend events, then there isn't even the perk of a social life. So a new model always emerges. But, of all of the different types of kind of communications agency, I think the media agency model is the bit that's most broken at the moment.
Okay, let's talk about the book for a little bit. Broadly, who is the audience for the book? Is it me?
No, probably two. And this is still the great unknown, I think, in terms of the publisher of the book, which is Hardy Grant, is the one sort of, I guess, the inner level of the onion, I suppose, is people working in some way in the communications industry, because obviously, they and we have lived and breathed it. So hopefully you will be interested in hearing how we've got to this point over the last decade. But then the second audience would obviously be sort of ordinary, intelligent Australians who care about the media and its contribution to the culture of the country and want to know how we got here. So I've tried to write it in such a way that it's not kind of patronizing in any way for people within our industry, but doesn't sort of assume knowledge on the part of those who sort of come from sort of slightly more sort of, you know, outside, you know, the next ring of the onion, I suppose.
Yeah, it feels like one of the more high-minded media books that'd be given away with a Crikey subscription.
Yeah, look, I think that's the sort of audience we're probably talking about, I suppose, you know. So yeah, and I, you know, one of the many things I've learned about sort of being involved in publishing books, because this is my first, is it takes a really long time to actually find out who is buying it. So you know, you can kind of, you know, glimpse charts on Amazon and that sort of thing, but for the numbers to come through takes a lot longer. So it's kind of, you know, I guess we're still sort of waiting to see.
So what was the original inspiration of the book? Because usually when someone leaves a media company and says they're off to write a book, they never actually do it, but you've done it.
Yes, it's that old joke about journalists, isn't it? One journalist says to the other, I'm writing a book, and the other one says, neither am I. So I began to have the idea probably a little bit more than a year ago now. So I got as far as writing a kind of synopsis, and it the central idea of looking back on the Australian media over the last decade, that sort of, and I was loosely thinking that 11-year decade of 2010 to 2020, you know, and how we got here, because that felt like something I, you know, through my time on Mumbrella had hopefully sort of qualified me to talk about. And my initial thought was that this would be a kind of, you know, chapter on Channel 9, a chapter on Bauer Media and so on. Mm. But then, as I came to sort of, and you know, and that was what Hardy Grant signed off on. But then when I came to sit down and write it, I just became really worried that that would be really stodgy and like a textbook. And it was going to be much harder to write, but hopefully much easier to read, would be to find a route through and actually tell a story. You know, that sort of, you know, I guess if there was a single thing that changed the sort of direction on the project, was chatting to a friend who'd written a book, and she just said the one thing she'd written, she said the one thing she wished was that before she wrote her book was that she'd understood the three act structure better. So I kind of did a crash course in the fiction three act structure. So, yeah. And that just gave enough of a framework for writing the book that hopefully turned it into more of a story than just, you know, a series of disconnected chapters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you become almost the protagonist in a story where it's really, you're the through line going through this as you gonzo journalist, like knocking on the door, finding pallets of newspapers. And then, you know, it's about your experience of walking through the lobbies and seeing the elevators.
Yeah, look, and something that sort of at the start of each chapter in the first two acts is there's usually some sort of observational piece or sort of first person piece, which you know, so I'd say that kind of, I guess as a proportion, is probably 90% in the third person and 10% in the first person, because of course, you know, I'm, you know, really not of much interest to the audience versus the story of the media. But sometimes when I was in the room and I saw something funny, it works better to tell the story in that way. So that was definitely a little part of, you know, one of those things you just don't really think about until you come to writing, and suddenly you're kind of having this structure with, okay, these bits are going to be, you know, in the first person present tense, and you know, things that happened prior to 2010 will be in perfect past tense, and things that happened from 2010 to 2020 in standard past tense, and all of those kind of structural things which you don't expect the reader to actually even notice, but hopefully makes it easier for them to navigate it when they're actually reading it.
Yeah. What's the reaction been to the book, particularly from those that are actually being mentioned within it?
You know, it's actually been pretty good. One of the things which has been, I guess, both pleasing and enormous relief is so far people who have featured or, you know, were around at the time, you know, more than one has kind of said, look, the bit that I know about, it's all accurate. You got it right. And that's been really encouraging, because, of course, you know, it's not like online publishing or magazine publishing, you can't do it again the next day, so you really want to get stuff right. And I think hey look, you know, talking about the sort of dying days of, you know, sort of, you know, or what felt like the dying days of newspapers, where all the levels of checking went. With books, at least they're still there, so you do go through a number of kind of, you know, processes, you know, and revisions with the, you know, with the publishers' kind of editors, which helps you begin to get there. So so look, I think, you know, I guess a really common for a lot of people is they've been impressed with the level of detail in it. A lot of them seem quietly relieved that it's not boring. that seems to have been a common thing. But yeah, as I say, I think the one that's been most pleasing for me is it. I get the sense from that certainly most people I've spoken to, you know, do feel that, you know, I've been kind of fair to them and you know, got to a truth.
Yeah. I guess maybe one of the things that's kind of interesting is that there's been such a turnover, a churn of a lot of the people that have been leading the media as well as various sort of figureheads, that by now it's people sort of reflecting back. And I tend to find people are more honest and open to what the situation was after the fact than when I've actually got some territory that needs to keep on defending. I'm just thinking that. Sorry, when I was reading the book, there was, and this is what I was thinking about with the media buyer party, there's a scene right at the beginning of the book where you've got a party to launch. Oh gosh, what was the party for? I forget. Oh, sorry, it was Nova launching.
Yeah, and it's just the new season of Nova.
Yeah, the new season of Nova. And you've got all the presenters from Nova, and these are all the big guys. And I was thinking there's maybe one person left from this entire roster of talent who's still a media presence in Australia. And this wasn't that long ago. It was like, what, 7-8 years ago?
Yeah, look, that's true. I mean, I suppose the thing is, on the talent side, yes, certainly it does make you realise that radio is quite transitory, particularly for the people who aren't at number one in any given market. I think what tends to happen with the executives is they might change jobs, but they don't tend to leave the industry in the same way. But yeah, certainly it was kind of, yeah, fascinating trying to piece together that Nova party that, yes, I was there. Frustratingly, one of the many YouTube channels that Mumbrella had had over the years had been deleted at some point by YouTube. There must have been a copyright strike or something that we'd missed at the time. So the video I shot at the event of, you know, there was a mishap involving the band, which was part of the story, is just gone. I've lost that. So that was for memory. But it was tracking down people who were executives at the time to check that my recollection and what I'd written at the time about the thing was true, finding old Getty images, photographs of the event that gave me clues who was there. And so in order to write something first person, you actually have to do quite a lot of background to check that what you vaguely remember from, you know, a funny little scene on a night out is actually accurate, yeah, a decade on.
So you, throughout the book, you do chart the decade starting around 2010-ish. How do you avoid going too much further back than that with any regularity throughout the book? So many of the problems that the legacy media has made in Australia stems back to the late 90s onwards, when media consumers first started getting online in a meaningful way. So how do you not keep on going further and further back to create this foundation for all these problems are now? Like, the book is very current and very concisely framed within this time period that you focused on.
Yeah, look, I suppose the thing is you do want to give your audience enough to lean on, as you say, to kind of frame it. So, you know, there was an awful lot of rereading of the books that had gone before to just give that little bit of context. So you'd often find, say, when I was talking about, I don't know, the situation Fairfax found it in at the start of the decade, I needed to sum up in two or three paragraphs, but that was actually probably had come from two or three books, or actually in Fairfax's case, even more than that. So, you know, it is making the decision to leave out as well as put in, because, you know, I absolutely was trying to write about the decade just gone. So that's definitely a part of the process, was making the judgment of giving just enough context. You know, and arguably I failed in that, you know, the original plan with the publisher was 80,000 words and ended up being 167,000.
While you're writing a book, did you have a opinion shift at all about some of the people you were covering or the industry really as a whole? So, I mean, while reading it, I sort of felt that it validated a lot of the concern that I'd had that we were kind of sort of seeing the end of things and things that probably could have been averted early on. So if you think about, say, newspapers, for example, in Australia, if like newspapers across the globe, really, Australia's actually held in newspaper-wise more than a lot of industries sort of globally. But when I think about newspapers, like they gave away their product really early on the internet and sort of set a framework where people never really expected they'd have to pay for news going forward. And I sort of think about sort of ideas like that. And then as I was reading your book, it just kind of cemented the idea that, yeah, that sort of line of thinking really does sort of hold true. Did you find anything sort of upset narratives while you were going a bit deeper into various issues like that?
I think probably the main thing was I certainly, just in thinking more deeply about it, began to spot themes or thoughts that had never really emerged before. And a lot of them, when you actually just say them aloud, are really obvious. But, you know, for me, one of the themes, particularly around newspapers, is that we had this decade where we transitioned from a business model where the audience was arguably the product, in that most of the money came for advertising. Mm. So you didn't care as much about the audience, to a model where subscribers are the most important thing, you know, whether it's online or whether it's in print, because that's where most of the money comes from. And that, I think, is quite a fundamental difference, because it then affects how newspapers are published. Not even just newspapers, you know, the obviously the online news equivalent, but also television as well, and subscription television news, because it's a slightly different model when you're giving the audience what it wants. So that has ramifications for society and all sorts of things. So that definitely, you know, was there all along, but took a little while just to think through, okay, yeah, this has actually been a real thing. And then there's plenty that, you know, yeah, I have changed my mind about. So, for instance, I was in the early days of Stan, for instance, I was very, very cynical about how successful it would be, particularly Fairfax's involvement in it. You know, the Fairfax and Nine put up, I seem to remember, it was $50 million each. You know, they committed to investing to getting it off the ground, which now looks like genius because its valuation is, you know, probably north of $1 billion. But at the time, it felt to me like this was just smoke and mirrors to give Fairfax something to talk to the ASX about, and that probably it wouldn't be real money. It would just be, you know, inventory they were giving away, you know, advertising inventory. But it was real. You know, they really did stump up that money, and it was obviously a great success. So that was certainly one of many where, particularly when it came to Fairfax, because they'd had such bad management for many years, that at the time, you know, I didn't really give Greg Highwood and his team the credit that, looking back now, I think they deserved.
I mean, just thinking about Stan, though, and this probably leads into my next question, which is a bit more future-looking. But if you think about Stan, like, I was very cynical about Stan at the very beginning as well. I was seeing smokes and mirrors for all sorts of other reasons that weren't necessarily related to the potential valuation of the company and how it was tying to the Fairfax of it all. But Stan's a company which I think has very smartly pivoted about 3 or 4 times successfully as it's negotiated around various content deals that have been signed by the organization. But I look at them now, and the current pivot seems to be in the direction of sport and trying to talk up the idea of Australian originals. I don't think the Australian originals thing really has a whole lot of legs to it, but sport, I definitely think they can really make some ground sort of movement there. But if you think about a company like Stan, like, outside of sport, what opportunities do they really have as we now face a media future of large international media companies all pushing their way into Australia to have a direct relationship with customers? Also, the tech giants are playing an equally sort of big role. Like, it just feels like it's squeezing out these little players like Stan. What can they really do other than lean into sport, which is the one thing that doesn't have a financial benefit to these international guys?
Yeah, well, let's come on to sport in a sec, because firstly, I'll challenge your premise when it comes to the premise of your question when it comes to originals. I think I understand the strategy, in that, let's say, it costs $30 million to do a short series of an original, then in the scheme of things, that's probably no more than making an acquisition. But of course, then that's something which can be sold on to other markets, or you can bring in funding right from the start for other markets. And of course, it's content that Stan has control of. And of course, this is always going to be the big challenge for Stan while it stands on its own as an Australian company, is it is no guaranteed long time, studio waterfall of new content, because of course the studios are all doing their own stuff as well. So I think it we'll probably see them doing more originals, and some will work and some won't, obviously.
On that, so the reason why, yes, I'm so gung-ho and feeling that originals aren't necessarily a huge sales proposition is that you think about the market for Australian films and the attendance of them. Occasionally you'll get a hit that really sort of connects with the zeitgeist, but there's a lot of stuff that comes and goes, and Australians are very dismissive about Australian content largely. And so you have to think, is selling yourself on Australian content being the driver for attention? It makes sense if you've got a large Australian library, but you've also got two or three other things that are driving you to that proposition. But with all their content libraries being snapped up elsewhere, that Showtime deal, which was great for Stan, is now over with Paramount Plus. That's launched since your book's been released. You look at that and then you think, well, what content are they actually bringing in? The best deal they've got at the moment is Peacock, which is like Peacock Originals. And NBC's looking at launching Peacock globally as well. So that's a short-term deal at best. So ultimately, Stan are left with Sport, which is an add-on subscription, and their primary product just being these Australian shows. And I'm not sure that's enough to get the mainstream swell that you need to be able to maintain a viable streaming service like that.
Look, it's probably one of a few things, isn't it? It's funny you mention Paramount Plus. I noticed in the... although in theory I've been taking the last few weeks off, I have been listening to everybody's podcasts and stuff, and I noticed the phrase that the team from Viacom CBS, the people behind 10 and Paramount Plus, kept using over and over again was the word tactical. And it feels like a lot of their content strategy around Paramount Plus, in terms of which sport to go for in particular, but also, which program is going to be tactical with, okay, we're just going to make sure we got something for every demographic. So my first impression hearing those interviews was that feels like a bit of a less focused strategy than some of the others. But then I guess that is the other big challenge for Stan, is it's a bit much to say it's unique, because I don't know, but it would certainly be one of the very few in the world where you've had a local player which has launched so successfully and become so big so successfully. And, you know, the kind of Reed Hastings from Netflix has given Mike Sneesby, credit as the CEO of Stan for having been one of the few competitors globally who's been able to do that. But I think if we were to look back about 2 to 3 years, I rather suspect that Nine at the time kind of assumed that they would probably be offering an equity stake to one of the US studios. And I think that was maybe one reason why it stayed independent of Nine, sort of, as an operation and culturally. But that's gone very quiet. So I'm not sure that's going to happen now.
I don't know who'd buy it. Like, it kind of feels too small fish.
It made sense at the time, but I'm not sure now it necessarily does, which I suppose is...
The thing that changed the game entirely was Disney Plus launching. So ultimately, I think a lot of the talk around Stan originally, when people were talking about an overseas company buying into it, is really for the email list. Like, once you've got those credit card numbers on file, once you've got like their subscriber base, then you can launch a streaming service from ground up. But Disney proved that you don't actually really need that. As long as you've got a compelling product that has some well-known IP attached to it, people will just flock to it. You don't actually need to buy up the credit card list in a way that was presumed that you'd need to be able to do that.
That's all you need, is to have the world's best content and you're fine.
But I mean, like, obviously Disney are at a very high advantage there, but then you look at the other competitors that would be the guys that would likely be either Disney or Warner Brothers with, wanting to launch HBO Max in Australia. None of those companies actually really need Stan, because they do have like these great content libraries. It's quite easy for them to be buzzy and get attention coming into the market.
Yeah, look, I think things have moved on, certainly from this thought they might take an equity stake in Stan. And that thinking about it, it's probably only 2 and a bit years. But yeah, that and the buzz seems to have gone out of that now. But, you know, the question people always keep asking about Stan is, well, can it keep going as it gradually loses these deals and others launch into the market? And as you say, you know, that then comes into sport as the new battleground, which, you know, it kind of looked like, again, 4 or 5 years ago, it looked like sports rights, the valuation of those had peaked. You know, the 7, 9 and 10 were all overbidding for their sports rights. Arguably, one of the things that put 7 in trouble was David Leckie having paid so much for AFL. You had 10 obviously actually did go into administration, and often it was sports rights were the problem. And then all of a sudden, sports rights are now worth more than ever because the streaming services have come through. Yeah. And they, of course, are this whole new set of customers. But also for those who buy sports rights, it gives them more than one way of realising value. It's not just about what's on free-to-air, but the fact that there's a sort of subscriber play as well.
Well, the joke that I always keep on coming across every time that there's a major sporting code up for grabs is always the talk of, oh, well, Amazon or Apple will come along. And there's always this idea that these big tech giants are kicking the tires on the local sport. But the reality is that they've never done it before. In most markets, like outside of the cricket in India, there hasn't really been a large acquisition of a sport in that way by any of these major streaming services, because it doesn't make a lot of sense, because it only works for that local market. It's a big expense that they can't, like, amortized across a number of different markets. Like, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense other than local companies bidding for their local sporting codes. And it's interesting seeing Paramount Plus actually doing that, because it's the first time you've really seen that, but it is in the US.
Yeah. And then of course you've got the soccer in the UK where that's split into at least 3 packages. And again, you've got Amazon Prime coming in for some of that as well. So we are beginning to see it. And, you know, remember how quickly this has actually become a thing. You know, absolutely. It's really only been in the last 2 years, you know. So I'm not sure where we're going to see it go. But it's, you know, the thing that fascinates me is what is the 2000, and this could be one of those things we know more by the time this goes up. The 2024 Olympics, you know, where will that sit? How will that actually be consumed in Australia? Because 7 have got the right of refusal on it, and they haven't said whether they're taking it up, or they certainly haven't said it at the time that we're recording this. And
well, it's a lot
getting kind of close.
It's an expensive thing to buy, so maybe 7's not quite in a position to be able to outlay that level of cash.
Well, that's the big question. But then, of course, the question is, can they bear to let one of their other competitors get it instead?
Oh, absolutely not.
That is always the nature of the competition.
Okay, let's lead this right into the end here. So I spent a lot of my time thinking about the future of Australian media. I largely backed out of it in terms of paid work because I wasn't senior enough to be able to milk it for what I could. And I was a pretty averagely paid employee in an industry that is, well, to call it a decline, I think is fairly polite. But where do you see local media 5 to 10 years from now? Do you think it maintains being a large mainstream proposition within Australia, or is it going to continue to start filling more niche needs? Is it maybe a way for legacy companies to maintain relevance by focusing more on the niche than it is this mainstream grab for real estate that it has been traditionally?
Now, firstly, to check the assumption, when you're talking about local media, you mean media locally rather than necessarily local newspapers or whatever?
Yes, like Australian-owned, well, owned and operated-ish. So, you know, obviously you've got your Murdochs, who obviously international sort of base, but things that we generally consider to be Australian media.
Yeah.
So local mastheads, local broadcasters.
Yeah, look, I suppose one of the things is over the last certainly 5 years, we've probably hit that point where when there's a big move that affects the media consumption of an Australian audience, I'd say now more than half of the time, the decision maker on that is sitting in Silicon Valley. They're not sitting in Australia. So that's been a change, you know, and that will only accelerate. You know, I think there'll be some sort of reckoning or breakup of some of the big power, the big players in Silicon Valley. But that, you know, that's sort of almost by the by. You know, where Australian media is hanging on by its fingertips, it's getting some pretty good, if good is the right word, protectionist help from its friends in government. So, you know, the News Media Bargaining Code obviously helped the big players lean heavily on Facebook and Google to give them some quite serious, you know, in the tens of millions amount of money to kind of, I guess, help underpin their model for the certainly near and maybe midterm future. So that kind of does make their model a little bit safer. I think where, and this is one of the reasons for sort of clarifying the question, is the one bit of the media I'm not sure I can feel that optimistic about at the moment, just because I can't see a model, is when it comes to actual sort of local community journalism. You know, that sort of journalism in the past used to be a local newspaper having a reporter sitting in every council meeting and every courtroom and, you know, popping into the police station once a day to see what had been going on. That's the bit that I don't think a new model has yet emerged to guarantee the future of.
Yeah, I can't wrap my mind around that either. I think that might just be a dead bit of journalism at this point going forward.
Which is a bit depressing to write off, because that's basically a massive chunk of democracy.
Mm. Oh, no, it absolutely is. Essentially, the changes happening within Australian media, like, you can't gloat over any of it, because really this is fundamentally attacking what makes Australia Australia.
Yeah, look, and you get back to that, that one of the quotes I used in the book, you know, business model, unfortunately, is not you'll miss us when we're gone.
Your book, Media Unmade, it's not a dry book by any means. And I just want to let people know that there is this chapter in here, which is called Phone Hacking Paywalls and Grin Fox. And to me, I think speaks completely to the spirit of this book. Tim Burrows, it's a fantastic read. Thank you very much for stopping by the Oz Media Report.
Dan, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
And that marks the end of the Oz Media Report for another week. Thank you very much for listening. While I've got your attention, can I maybe just recommend that you subscribe to Always Be Watching? It's a daily newsletter that I push out. It's usually in your inbox by about 9 a.m. and it's all the news related to TV, streaming, and various other screens that you might be using to consume your entertainment. And it covers basically all the interesting news happening from the US, from the UK, Australia, and anywhere else where there might be interesting news-related things happening. You can find that at alwaysbewatching.com. But this has been the Oz Media Report. If this is your first episode, take a look back through our archive. There's some interesting stories related to the Australian media industry. We'll be back next week with more conversations about media. Thank you very much for listening. I'll be back next week.